This week, January 27th, 2015, on The Digital Story, a photographer in Cuba, the sights, sounds, and people of this Caribbean island. All of this and more with yours truly, Derek Story, on The Digital Story. Welcome back to another Digital Story. I'm thrilled to be back here with you. And when I say back here, I mean in Santa Rosa. I made the trip from Havana to Miami and then Miami to the West Coast. And I'm in the studio recording today's podcast about Cuba. You figured that out already. You heard the introduction. You're listening to the music. By the way, the music today will be provided compliments of Fiesta Campesina. They're a five-piece band that I met during lunch one day. Almost every lunch that we had had music also. And then when the band takes a break, they have their homemade CDs. And I mean homemade. I mean inkjet-printed covers and song lists. Just a regular sort of CD. This is a brand I've never even seen before of CD, but it's a regular CD like you'd buy in the store. They rip them, and then they sell them for 10 pesos. It's universal. Sell them for 10 pesos, and you can take home music from the band that you listen to at lunch or wherever you happen to be. It's a pretty cool tradition. I came home with 5 of these CDs, so I've got plenty of music for all my projects. They usually sign them for you, so you have the band members on there. And they're just really nice mementos, very affordable, and really a memory that just keeps giving because you can listen to the music on and on and on. I've already ripped them all, and so I've digitized them so I can listen to them on my various devices. The only catch is, and those of you that love audio will appreciate this, you know, these CDs aren't in the CD database online. So instead of automatically filling in the song titles and all the metadata, you have to do it by hand, just like the old days. Yeah, which I've done because, you know, I want this stuff. So anyway, we're going to talk all about Cuba today. I'm going to tell you a little bit about photography, a little bit about the people. And if you're thinking of going, this podcast will help you. And if you can't go, I think this podcast will definitely add to your knowledge about this wonderful Caribbean island country. So let's start out today with a snapshot, and then I'll roll into the meat of the show. Oh, yeah. So my moments actually came outside of Havana. We started out in Havana, and then we did some touring to some other cities, Santa Clara, Trinidad, and a few more. And then we worked our way back and stayed the last few days in Havana, which was a really good plan. So our first stop on this tour outside of Havana was in Santa Clara, which is it was about 3-hour drive from the city center. And one of the first stops that we had in the afternoon, and this whole trip was what we call a people-to-people tour. So at the moment, even with things relaxed a little bit between the U.S. and Cuba, generally speaking, you can't just get on a plane and fly to Cuba and go wander around. You have to be part of something. And one of the ways that you can be part of something is what we call a people-to-people tour. The idea being that you, as a small group, in our case of Americans, go and you meet artists, you meet businessmen, educators, all these different people in Cuba, and actually learn about the country essentially from the inside out. Of course, there's plenty of time to take pictures and to drink rum and do all that fun stuff. But these meetings that we had were very special. And the most special one for me was at the Art School of Santa Clara. Now, when we drove up to this school, I actually thought, we all thought, it was an abandoned building. So during the Russian period in Cuba's history, when right after the revolution and when the alliance with Russia was strong, and this would be 1960, 61, that period there. One of the things that the Russians did was they brought over their prefab housing style and built all sorts of apartments and factories and schools and stuff with this very sort of plain concrete slab design of a building. And you don't paint it. It's just, you know, boom concrete. It has even number of openings for windows, just sort of straight up and down. Not a whole lot of design there. And over time, these things, they age oddly in the sense that you really can't tell from the outside, you know, is this building abandoned or not? It just has that look to it. And usually the grounds around the building are a little disheveled. I don't mean trashy or anything. I just mean there isn't really any landscaping. There might be actually, you know, some building material and stuff stacked up here and there. And that's what the school was like. So we drive up and we get out, and the director of the school sees us. And this is for children, mainly grammar school age, up right until high school. And then after high school, you know, they can go on to a performing arts school or wherever, whatever they're going to do. Now, education in Cuba, along with healthcare, is covered by the government. So there's no charge to the families for this school or any of the other schools. However, as children move on, they have to demonstrate aptitude. They basically list their top interests in order, and then depending on how they test and so forth, that will determine what areas they will get to move on to. So these children were into the arts and the performing arts. So there was ballet, guitar, quartets, a string quartet, and then the grand finale was a full orchestra. And, you know, the children, they wear school uniforms, and this orchestra had basically everything. It was a full orchestra with a conductor, with these little kids and their instruments in this building that looked like, you know, it had been bombed, but that's just the way this building was designed and had aged. And of course, you know, the children themselves, they don't have a lot of school supplies. You know, it's very, as throughout Cuba, the people are doing exceedingly well based on the resources they have, but they don't have the resources that you see in the U.S. and Germany and France and in places like that. So you see these children with their instruments, and they're sitting in their folding chairs, and there's a conductor, and, you know, your expectations are, well, you're going to support them no matter what, right? So they start playing, and they were playing selections from Phantom of the Opera. And they were playing them amazingly. So here we are. We're sitting in kind of this open area with a mural from the Revolution on one wall there. Open on both ends, so a breeze is blowing through. Americans sitting in card chairs in one end, and children in card chairs playing music in the other. And the most beautiful sounds we had ever heard. I actually recorded some of it. And you're sitting there, and the whole feeling from the moment just overtakes you. And, you know, it's hard to describe, but, you know, you've probably been through it, you know, in different situations throughout your life, too. But the sight of these children, so dedicated to what they're doing, against, I would say, you know, some substantial challenges, the artistry in which they performed the music, and then just the way the music itself hit you, it was hard not to cry. I mean, so we're sitting here, and of course, I'm supposed to be filming this for the movie that I'm working on, and other people were, you know, supposed to be taking stills and all this. And the snapshot was, we just all stopped on our end. We just all stopped. We We put down our cameras, we put down our notepads, we put down everything, and just let these children take us away. And it was quite a moment. And even now, I have a hard time keeping a straight face while I talk about it. And that's this week's Snapshot. Story number one, Cuban basics. We'll start with currency. Currency is always a good place to start when you're going somewhere new. At the moment I'm recording this, you can't exchange American dollars for CUCs, C-U-C's, which is the Cuban convertible peso, at an exchange at the airport or anywhere else like that. And at the moment, and all of this is subject to change depending on how talks go between the U.S. and Cuba. But at the moment, you can't even go into a bank in Cuba and do business. What you have to do is you have to take the money with you that you're going to be spending while you're in that country. And then when you go to your hotel, the hotels handle all the currency exchange. And it's very legitimate. I mean, the bigger hotels actually will put up the conversion rate on a board, just like you would see at an exchange center in a bank or anywhere else. The smaller ones do it at the same rate. Right now, the rate is a little less than a dollar to one convertible peso. It's actually, for every dollar you convert, you get like 0.87 peso. So, but it's not too bad at all. It's a pretty good conversion. There sometimes could be a little bit of a service charge, sometimes not. It sort of depends. That will vary a little bit depending on the establishment. So you take your cash and you get the convertible pesos, and then that's what you use. They have folding money, 3, 5, 10, 20s. And I think 50s were the most common bills that I saw. And then they have coins. And the 1 peso coin is probably the most useful piece of money in Cuba, because almost everything is a peso. And what I mean by that is that if someone helps you with something, you give them a peso. If you tip someone, it's usually a peso. If you ask someone if you can take their picture, and you take it, and then you give them a peso. So having a pocket full of these pesos is very helpful. Now, there's another currency in Cuba. It's the peso also, but it's not the convertible peso. And that currency is not a hard currency. It's not... We can't even use it as Americans, and it's not worth very much. It's only worth a fraction of a convertible peso, or a CUC, or a CUC, are all different names for the same thing. So you may hear about the other currency, but it's not really an issue for us. And any currency that you would use in Cuba should say convertible peso on it. It puts it right on there. And that's what you use. Now, generally speaking, things are affordable. So if you want to have a rum, a Havana Club rum, let's say a three-year-old rum, they have the everyday rum that they use for mojitos, and then they have a three-year, seven-year, and the premium rum. That's all how long they've been aged. You can have a very nice drink with a couple ice cubes. It's delicious. And it'll be less than 2 pesos. So if you buy artwork, which I did bring home some artwork, beautiful lithographs or whatever, that will usually run between 10 and 30 pesos. Again, very affordable. The CDs that I bought were like 10 pesos. So it's not super expensive to get around. Meals are affordable, usually around 7-8 pesos for a very nice meal. And they do meals very well. Anyone that has done any research on Cuba, they say don't eat in the hotels, eat in the palatas, or basically what they call over there the private restaurants. And I'm going to talk about that in the next segment. We'll start with the water. So it should be eating and drinking in Cuba. So the tap water is fine in Cuba, but it's not fine for Americans. And it's clean and all that sort of stuff, but it just has different bacteria in it than what we're used to. So you don't drink the tap water. You know, that's like rule one. Always have bottled water. Everywhere has bottled water. So I never really found that to be an issue at all. So I either had bottled water or beer. They basically have two beers in Cuba. They have a light and a medium one. I like the light one. It was called Cristal. It's in a green can or a bottle, and it's really refreshing. It's delicious. Actually, it usually costs you a peso for a beer there. It doesn't cost very much. So you stay away from water. You can brush your teeth with water, obviously. Just don't swallow it. You know, rinse and spit, all that kind of stuff. And I just followed those basic rules, and I didn't have any problems at all with my GI tract. Now, when it comes to food, as you would guess, unfortunately, I had to stay away from a lot of salads and so forth, again, related to the water. But fruit that grows in a tree or things like that, not a problem at all. I had bananas and mangoes all the time, quite delicious, and had no problems at all. But I did find by the end of my stay, I was really wanting of a fresh salad because I eat salads a lot. I live in California and we eat salads all the time. So that was a little different. In terms of food, there's, when you're near the coast, as you would guess, there's a lot of seafood. There's also beef and pork and chicken. And you don't get beef like a steak or anything. The beef is almost always shredded or chopped and served with a sauce. Now, one of the things that you find is that over the course of the week that a lot of the food begins to seem the same. And that's because they're basically growing and raising their own food. One of the things that happened to Cuba with the collapse of the Soviet Union was that the Soviet Union, who had been providing them with fertilizer, pesticides, you know, those petroleum-based things, gas, all that kind of stuff, that all basically went away. And it really sent Cuba into a rough time. They call it the special years. Basically, it was the equivalent of the Depression in the U.S. because suddenly, you know, you're getting hardly anything from outside of the island. Your main source of support stops supporting you. So at first, it was very difficult on them. In fact, the average Cuban at the beginning of the special period, and again, this is coincides with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Gorbachev time, the average Cuban lost around 20 pounds, you know, just to give you an idea. And what they had to start doing was farming everywhere. So urban farms, community farms, all that stuff just started to happen. Actually, some folks from Australia came over and helped them learn about permaculture and organic farming. And right now, at this time in Cuba, almost anything that you eat is organic. They are an organic food country. They have learned. They made it through this very difficult period where they didn't have fertilizers. They didn't have pesticides. They learned how to farm without them. They learned how to not farm on these gigantic farms, but much smaller farms, because everything had to be done by hand. And I mean, they couldn't even run the tractors anymore. So they actually had to go back to ox. And they had to replenish the soil. The soil had been dependent on fertilizers. Take away the fertilizers, the soil was basically dead. So they had to bring the soil back to life by tilling in, plant material and so forth. They made it through all of that. And the food now that you get there may not have a lot of variety, but it is clean and it is healthy. And it is really quite amazing. So you also have rice, you have frijoles, beans, All the friolis are basically the same. They're sort of a black bean in sauce. You'll have whatever produce happens to be available, and then whatever meats or fish happen to be available, prepared based on the sauces of that particular restaurant or family. So not a whole lot of variety, but what they do have is quite good. And then there's usually a dessert. You usually start out with a cocktail, a mojito. The mojito is the cocktail, which is some sort of fruit, usually with leaves of mint stuck in there, and then they add a little bit of rum. And I tell you, I didn't gain weight in Cuba, and I didn't lose weight. I ate quite well. The portions were fine. And I was very impressed with what they've done, and how, at the moment anyway, not only can they support their people, but they can also support, you know, folks like me that are coming over and visiting. All right, segment number 3, cars. There's no way I'm going to bypass talking about cars on a podcast about Cuba. The automobiles there are incredible. So now, you've probably seen pictures of modern day Cuba, and you see these classic American cars, Fords, Chevys, old Cadillacs, Oldsmobiles, all that stuff. So there's a reason for that. By the way, these cars are referred to in Cuba as Yank Tanks, which I love that name. They're Yank Tanks. So at the time that President Batista was ousted and Fidel Castro took over, you know, the revolution in Cuba, 1959, well, then right after that, of course, the U.S. embargo hit. And when the U.S. embargo hit, that meant that there were no more parts or anything else for basically 150,000 American cars that were in Cuba at this time. So here we go. So we have all these cars. Let's pick 1961. And there are no parts for them, but they're beautiful cars. So what's happened is that Cubans have become, as a whole, excellent mechanics. And I don't mean just, you know, repairing the cars, you know, like doing a tune-up and things like this. I mean actually designing their own parts, replacement parts for the cars, fabricating things like front grills and bumpers and stuff. So as the original ones rust and you know, finally are no good anymore, or the car's in an accident or whatever, then there are little cottage industries that have developed in Cuba that make the bumpers, that make the grills, that make brake pads, that make, you know, basically everything that the car needs. They have figured out how to either cannibalize from another car or make the parts. Now, when you take your car into a mechanic in Cuba and they identify, you know, what your car needs in terms of parts, and this would be for body and internals both, then it is the owner's job to find the parts. So the mechanic doesn't do that. Now, the mechanic can put it all together and make it work, but the owner has to find, let's say, the bumper, has to find the brake pads, has to find whatever's needed. And so there's this kind of constant sort of networking and search and asking around and all this. And some of these people who make the replacement parts are they're heroes in Cuba. They're amazing craftsmen who can take the original part that's rusted and broken, but there's enough of it so that they can copy that design and then create a replacement part that fits. The upshot is that there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, thousands of these cars on the road and running right now. And especially in the big cities like Havana, these cars are everywhere. And I photographed as many as I could, and they're just beautiful. I was mesmerized by them. Now, these cars are like having a second job. So if you are lucky enough to own one of these cars, basically maintaining it is a second job. It is something that is your passion. That is what you do. And, you know, we talked to people who talked about how hard it is to get paint and those materials, and how they would even paint their car with a sponge. And then you look at the car and you go, you painted that with a sponge? How long did it take you? Oh, it took me weeks. And you look at it and it's fabulous. Same thing with the interior, same thing with every part of the car. And so the people that have these cars and who are keeping them running, it is their pride and joy. I have mixed feelings about as Cuba does become more modern, and especially if the embargo is ever lifted and, you know, suddenly it's easier for other cars to come in and all that. Because right now it is such a joy to drive on the Cuban roadways and see, you know, at least half the cars be these beautiful, loved American classics, just driving like they were brand new. It's really something else. Now, the last thing I'll say about cars and driving in Cuba is that there's one highway and there are hardly any cars on it. And it is so weird. I shot footage of this, to be driving on a three-lane or four-lane freeway and basically have maybe one or two cars in front of you in the distance and one or two cars behind you. And these classic American cars that are so well kept just add so much to the urban landscape of Havana and the other cities. Segment number four, photography. So as you figured out, I say photography for last because I sort of wanted to set the stage a little bit. But photography is fun in Cuba, and especially in the area that I was, you know, Havana, Trinidad, Santa Clara, those areas. It's fun for a number of reasons. We'll start with people. First of all, the people are not adverse to having their picture taken. They're not weird about it. And only if you make it weird does it become weird. If you're making eye contact, if you're interacting, if you're really just being, you know, polite about how you go about your business. I think one person in our group had someone ask them not to take their picture during the whole time we were there. So over 10 days. So the people stuff isn't a problem. Now, this is getting back to the pesos, though. If you ask someone if you can take their picture, or if you take their picture and then interact with them, don't take their picture and run away. That would be bad. So either way, if you have an interaction, you know, and a photo, then it's customary to tip them one peso. So you see a guy on the street, he looks interesting, you take his picture, you go up and thank him, and you give him a peso. And that's what he's expecting, and that's what you should do. So tipping in Cuba is just an easy way for this all to happen. And I really liked it because I got posed pictures, I got natural pictures, I got lots of people pictures, and I can't think of any time in U.S. or anywhere else where I had more fun street shooting people, because it was just so out on the table. We're there with our cameras and taking pictures. They're being photographed. You give them a peso and you move on. It was like a win-win for everyone. So that part was really cool. I always would try to start out the day with at least 10 peso coins in my pocket. And my goal was by the end of the day to have hardly any left. Now, of course, you're using them for other things too, you know, for other types of tipping. But I tried to use the bulk of mine on people shots. Now, in terms of architecture, there is a lot of interesting architecture in different states of repair. And, you know, one of the places that I really enjoyed shooting was in Old Havana, because they're basically preserving it. And the buildings are absolutely just, they're stunningly gorgeous. And one of the things, of course, is that they have plazas everywhere. I like plazas. I like, because they usually have good-looking buildings surrounding the plaza, and there's usually something going on in the plaza. And of course, because it's a plaza, you can get back, you have space to work, so you can shoot the buildings on the other side. And so these things are great. And if I were scouting shoots, if I was, you know, going there and doing some of the planning myself, I would definitely look for cities that had plazas that were, you know, popular and photogenic. And I would center a lot of my shooting around those areas, because you can get everything. You know, people are gathering there. Beautiful buildings are there. You have a working room. And I think it's just a good way to go about the buildings and so forth. At some point, you're also going to want to get cars, you know, because people are going to think you're wacky if you come back without car shots. And I would say downtown is a great place for cars, or anywhere that attracts taxis, because what a lot of Cubans have done that have these cars, in order to sort of supplement their habit, they offer rides or there are official taxis. So anywhere that taxis are, almost always a taxi in, you know, a busy urban area is going to be a classic car in Cuba. You're going to see these cars and you're going to see a whole lot of them. And then you can just hang out, photograph them while they're parked, photograph them as they're coming around the corner, you know, in a busy intersection, all that stuff. And make sure you get lots of car shots. I would also add that if you don't normally shoot video with your camera, if you're mainly a stills person, and I'm in that category myself, I would bone up a little bit on using video with your camera before you go. Because there are just so many opportunities for shooting video. And the reason why I say that is the music is a big driving force. There is so much music and so many artists, musicians and other types, that the stills are nice, but to really capture, you know, what is going on there, video does such a nicer job of it. Now, a lot of times I would just use the audio recording on my camera. I was shooting with the OMD EM10, and I can adjust the gain manually with it. So if the music was louder than normal, I would, you know, move that all the way down, like minus 10 decibels, so that it didn't clip too much on the high end, and try to get the best audio possible. I also took a separate audio recorder, and I'm really glad I did, because there were moments when I was using that, and then obviously I'm recording the audio with the video too, and then you can swap out the really good audio with the audio recorder for the average audio from the camera. But I would say that video was probably as important in Cuba as anywhere else I've been. And I would recommend, you know, boning up on it and being ready to shoot video and then augmenting your stills with it. And then you have the complete package. Don't take too much gear. I mean, really, I can't emphasize this enough. I published the kit that I took, the picture of it, and, you know, everything when I was going from A to B, so from Miami to Havana or Havana to Santa Clara, whatever, would fit in a little ProTactic 350 that would slide under seats, that would fit in those kind of narrow bus shelves overhead. You know, anywhere it had to go, it would fit. And then in my suitcase, I had a very lightweight shoulder bag. During the day, I just used the zooms for my OMD. So I used the 14 to 42 pancake zoom, the Olympus, the power zoom, and then the Panasonic 35 to 100, the compact one, and they performed great and were fantastic during the day. Don't forget a polarizing filter. I can't believe how many people did not bring polarizing filters. You need it not for the sky so much. The sky is already really blue, but there's so much light bouncing around off the buildings and everything that the polarizer really helps cut down those reflections and really allow you to capture the color of the buildings and the foliage and everything. I found that really helpful, and I use the polarizer a lot during the day. Then at night, when we're going out to eat and wandering around the plazas at night and doing all that stuff, then I switch to prime lenses, and I use two prime lenses, the 17mm f1.8 and the 75mm f1.8, and that was great. So I'd lock up the zooms in the safe, and I'd carry the primes at night and vice versa. It just worked wonderfully. It was absolutely great. That is the basic approach. I took two bodies, but you know what? I only used one the whole time, the EM10. And, I had a backup body if I needed it, but I didn't. And I didn't really use flash very much, very little flash at all. Almost everything was handheld. And, the videos and the still pictures are terrific. Now, I didn't post a lot from Cuba, as you probably know if you follow. Services are up and down. And our phone service worked. I had an international card. Our phone service worked the first couple days in Havana. The last three, it did not. And not just for me, but for everyone. Boom, no cell service. Internet is very expensive and not very fast. At the moment, they don't have the fiber optic coming over from Venezuela. That project hasn't been finished, so all of their internet is satellite-based. So you can imagine how slow and expensive that is. That would be nice if the embargoes ever lift or anything, it'd be great to run fiber optic from the U.S. into Cuba and really open up their internet. But you really can't count on it. You don't know when you're going to be able to get it, and when you can, pretty expensive, usually on average about $6 an hour for internet that's slow. That means so you're not working fast. You're working very slowly. And you never know when you're going to have it. So, posting and so forth in real time, not very easy. In a way, you were sort of relieved of the responsibility of having to worry about what's going on with your cell phone and your computer, because it can't connect anyway. So what the heck, go take pictures and have some rum. Oh, yeah! As you can imagine, there is so much more to talk about, but I'm already running over, and I do think I've given you a bit of feel for the situation. If you're interested in going to Cuba, it's easier now than it was even a few months ago because they've opened up more categories for group visitation. I highly recommend the people-to-people tours because you do get to meet and photograph very interesting and very real people. There are other categories too. And the only thing I'll say is that try to avoid being part of a group that's larger than a dozen or so, because that is just too unwieldy for getting around, for eating, for doing all that kind of stuff. So 12, 14, that's about it. Any bigger than that, I would look for a different situation. All right, let's do a little virtual camera club business, and then we'll listen to some more music and sign off. I want to give a big shout out to Sizzle Pics. In fact, I'm going to be making some Sizzle Pics from some of my Cuban images. Sizzle Pics is the perfect way to output your best shots from an adventure like this. It will hold the color and the vibrancy of your best images. They last, virtually at least as long as you will. SizzlePix.com. They have a tile on all the pages of the digital story. And then Red River Paper. I'm going to be making some greeting cards in part to accompany gifts that I brought back from Cuba. And I've already identified some of the shots. Red River Paper has everything that you need to do these fine art greeting cards. And I'm thinking about actually doing a whole set of cards, you know, just where the cards are the gift too. They would be blank on the inside. And they have a tile on all the pages of the digital story. And you can get the cards, you can get the envelopes, you can get glassine sleeves, you can even get your ink if you have a Canon or Epson printer. Basically everything you need. And when you do a trip, such as what we're talking about today, building a set of fine art cards and just printing them out and having them, I think will make you very happy many times over when you want to send a note to somebody, when you want to give a set of cards as a gift. Let's say that maybe you weren't able to bring someone back a bottle of rum or a box of Cohiba cigars, but you can give them a set of six greeting cards, fine art greeting cards of your best shots from Cuba. Believe me, they're going to love those too. You don't have to put them in your suitcase or anything because they're just digital files until you get home and put them on Red River paper. So that's just really something to keep in mind, whether you're traveling to Cuba or Bermuda or France or wherever. It's a great option when you can't bring gifts home for everyone, but yet you can create a spectacular gift for them. I'm very just moved by the entire experience. And I think what touched me the most were the people that I toured with. We became very close. And then the people that I met in Cuba, including our driver and our guide, we became very close with. It was a life-changing experience. There's really no way about it. If you have a chance to go, I recommend it. Next week, we'll get back to regular photography stuff. I hope you've enjoyed this virtual tour of my experiences in Cuba. All right, see you next week. Bye-bye now. Thank you.